So what I'd like to speak about briefly is I was serving the winter retreat here, fortunately, this past winter. And during that time, just before it began, I learned that my stepmother, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's about 2 years ago, was going to be entering hospice. And so I knew that during the course of the retreat, it was quite likely that she would die. And the community was generous in anticipating and giving permission up front for me to leave the retreat as necessary for short amounts of time. And so I want to just talk a little bit about the experience of being a Buddhist in the context of my stepmother's death and my family. And there are a couple of things that come to mind. My family is not Buddhist. I'm the only Buddhist member of my family. And in fact, my father is very actively atheist. I mean, he's not a member of the society or anything, but he's an actuary. And when he had a heart attack some years ago, I said, "Dad, were you scared?" He said, "No, you know, I knew I was going to die sometime." So that's kind of, you know, in some ways he has a very genuinely equanimous attitude towards death. And so he was quite full of grief during this process of my stepmother declining. And at the time that she was going to go into hospice, she, after living in various facilities, she still recognized everybody more or less, and she still remembered her life. And she had stopped being able to eat. Or she moved, she was living in a Catholic facility, and that's important. She had moved there because it was taking two people to lift her, and she needed to be in a place where that was acceptable. And she had an advance directive. She didn't want any, you know, she didn't want to be kept alive artificially, and my whole family was supportive of that. But at some point, she lost the ability to eat, and so she, the home where she was, contacted my stepbrother and asked for permission to put a feeding tube in. And I think no one really understood the ramifications of that. So a feeding tube was put in, and then once it was in, it could not be removed at the facility where she was. So my family's concern was that she could be alive and in a vegetative state, you know, for quite a long time. So it took quite a long time for her to get from where she was into hospice. And along the way, I wasn't involved in this process, but, and this is one point I wanted to bring up, that my stepbrother did a really wonderful job of articulating to the facility where she was why we wanted her to be, to have the feeding tube removed. And the people at the facility very lovingly and respectfully said, "No, we can't do that because of our beliefs." So there are these gaps. If you, even if you have an advanced directive, you can't always see the ramifications of decisions that are made, even when they're made, even when they're the best decision at the time. So anyway, she ended up finding a place where she could be in hospice, contracting with a hospice service, because this is how it works in LA, apparently, and being moved from where she was to a hospital, having the feeding tube removed, staying at my stepbrother's house with private care overnight, and then going to the hospice where she ultimately died, because they couldn't accept her with a feeding tube and not use it. So this all took about, you know, 48 hours or something. And during that time, she was quite alert and happy because she was surrounded by people who loved her, and she still had nutrition. But when she got to the hospice, she really was ready to die. And so she let go very quickly, day by day. There was a change. And at that point, I went down. And so I had a lot of opportunity to think about how I wanted to be, what I could bring to the situation. And I knew that my father was very uncomfortable being around her. I think he was just so aggrieved that he couldn't tolerate being with her for very long. So he would go see her, but he couldn't, you know, he'd make the hour drive and then half an hour later say, well, I gotta go. So at the point where she, having reflected on death and dying and having some experience with people dying, I knew that when someone isn't responsive, they can still hear. So I was able to tell my father that, which he had no idea of, and just that allowed him to be more comfortable just expressing his love for her. And at this point, she was still alert enough that when we entered the room, they had a very happy marriage. So her eyes would just follow my father, and she would kind of light up. So that was, I thought that was a real benefit. And my brother also is almost phobic about hospitals, hospices, and death. And so just by being a calm, confident, and clear presence there, I felt like that allowed him to be present as well. So I think that's the main thing for me is having, as a Buddhist, reflected on death, you know, the daily reflections and the constant encouragement to look at it as a reality for everyone we know and for ourselves. Then to bring that at least passing familiarity and superficial comfort with it to other people was beneficial. Let's see. Another thing that is sort of tangentially related to what we've been talking about, but I think it comes out of practice, is being willing to be being comfortable with other people's discomfort. So at one point, when my stepmother was no longer responsive but clearly could benefit from someone being there and swabbing her lips and stuff like that, my father kind of said, okay, you can go home now. And he's my father. And so I kind of did, like I left. And then I thought, wait a minute, I know that that it's beneficial for people to be there. So I just went back, and the next time my dad came to visit, there I was. I hadn't gone anywhere. So that was interesting. Let's see what else. I'll just skip because I don't want to go on too long. But then after she died, inspired by John's example, another member of the retreat crew, his mother died at the beginning of the retreat. So the two of us decided to do a meal offering, and then everybody on the retreat and beyond got involved. And we made a giant Indian meal for the Sangha, which was lovely to do. And we had a great time doing it. And then just last week, I came out of retreat and I had dinner with my father and my aunt and other members of my family who, you know, probably will never come to the monastery, and it's okay, but they don't want to come here. And just sharing with them what we had done and describing the whole process, everybody getting involved. There was just, they lit up, and there was such a feeling of mudita and of just the blessings of that continuing on. So I think there are so many other ways that that practice helped me. The community chanted for her on the day that she died, and so feeling the support here when I was there, feeling the support of the community here was wonderful. And I was driving through LA to get to the hospice, and it's like listening to some music. I thought, no, wait a minute. So I started listening to the 28 Buddhas protection chant, and that really helped me when I was there. And it helped me also. There can be a lot of fireworks among, you know, old family dynamics can come up and bring a lot of dukkha. And so that happened one of my first visits. And so the next time, in between, I reflected, well, how do I want to go and be with my family? And I just thought, well, I want to go as a samana, as, you know, someone who's cultivating peace. And if referring to the Acrobat Sutta, which some of you are familiar with, if I just look after myself, my own body and speech and mind, that's enough, that's all I can do. But that helped create harmony in the whole family, even in a very stressful